It's absolutely, absolutely, absolutely brutal out there. If you look at the bubbles, they're completely red. If you look at Bitcoin, it's actually below $80,000. And you know what it's doing? It's actually playing out exactly as MM Crypto said. He said December closed as a shooting star. And what he did was he predicted that actually we'd get a pattern like this, which is exactly what's actually happening. So you got this little double top here, and then you got the shooting star breaking down. Now, I guess that what we need to do, as we've been saying for the last couple of days, is we need to brace and make sure that we're holding all the right tokens, that we're willing to hold multi-cycle. And then we just need to survive, because in crypto, really, if you survive, that's pretty much when you make the life-changing money. One of those tokens, which has been probably one of the better performing tokens, but certainly one of the fastest blockchains out there, is a blockchain called Sonic. It is a blockchain which was created by Andre Crenier, and it's probably one of the best blockchains out there. In fact, it's not probably, it's definitely one of the fastest blockchains out there. But it's not only about speed. Speed is one thing. I sat down with Andre Crenier this week, and I had a chat to him about what he built when he built Sonic. And let me tell you, it was the most incredible thing I have ever seen. When you listen to this interview, Andre's knowledge and him telling you what he built is going to absolutely blow your mind. In fact, I would be super surprised if after watching this video, you didn't land up buying Sonic. So we're not going to spend a lot of time on the markets today, because I think we are where we are. I think today we're going to talk about Sonic and why it is one of the best blockchains out there, if not the best blockchain out there. If that sounds good to you, what I need you guys to do is obliterate the like button, subscribe to the channel. Let's see if we can get to 1.2 million subscribers in this downward market, and let's get the show on the road. As I said, obliterate the like button. Also, remember, our Friday shows are actually sponsored shows. They're sponsored by NordVPN. And I've said to you before a million times, and especially after the Bybit hack and our friend Pete from House of Crypto was hacked, you're now realizing that there's a lot of ways to lose money in crypto. One of the ways is you'll lose a trading, and everyone will lose money trading at some point. Hopefully, you'll make more money than you lose. But the other way is to actually get your funds stolen from you. And that's to me, is even worse, especially if you could prevent it. I think the best tool in preventing something like that is just to get yourself a VPN, because a VPN masks your IP address. So as you can see here, this is my IP address. Everyone knows where I am. I'm in South Africa. The hackers know where I am. The governments know where I am. The dApps know where I am. Everybody knows where I am. But if I get a VPN, which looks like this, I can literally pretend that I'm anywhere in the world. And so not only can I watch like Netflix and F1 and all those things that I can't watch anywhere else, but also I can pretend to be from Cambodia, which means that hackers and the authorities just simply won't know who I am. Now, for me, this is the most valuable tool in crypto, really, because the risk return, you pay like, well, just watch this, you pay like $2 a month and or $3 a month, and you literally save your crypto. Now, there's a one-time offer here where you save 73% and you get 4 extra months, and you can exit within 30 days if you're not happy. That is under the link below. Just go and do it, please. You'll be supporting our channel, number one. Not only that will you be supporting our channel, but you'll also be protecting your crypto. Anyway, with that out the way, and I'm sure you guys are going to do it, let's actually talk about what we wanted to talk about today, and that is the fastest blockchain out there. And that's not as per what they say, it's as per what everybody else says. And so for that, I've got Andre Crenier with us. So I think without any further ado, let's get the man of the moment back on the stream. Andre, good to see you, my friend.
So, Brian, that's my first time. Me and you have had a few talks in coffee shops, but this is my first time on the show.
I think you've been on Banter before. I'm almost sure you've been on. I think you've been on Banter before. Andre, where have you been, and what have you been building, sir? I mean, you went into hibernation. I would say after there was the Phantom, I don't know what you call it, when you launched you launched solidly. We didn't hear from you for a while. You've now resurfaced with Sonic. Maybe just walk us through what's happened since and where you've been.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, everything up to, so I mean, I launched Yearn, and then I got my first sort of SEC investigation letter. Thought I dealt with that, and then another letter came and another letter came. And by the time I got to launching solidly, like just needing to deal with them, if I'm being honest, probably took up 80% of my time.
Wow.
and spoke to a lot of guys, and the general consensus was, look, you need to like step away. You can't be public facing anymore. So, you know, that's when we decided to shut down most of those websites. I mean, obviously all the apps still ran, but those websites were all, you know, hosted by me on like my servers and stuff. And like, that was basically the angle of attack, because, you know, they can't really argue about a decentralized smart contract, but they can be like, you're hosting the website that gives access to it. So shut that stuff down, you know, killed my Twitter, completely moved away from all public facing stuff, didn't do interviews, didn't do anything. Obviously still working closely with the Phantom team, but that was behind closed doors. Spent the better part of the next, I think, year and a half, maybe even longer, that was longer. That was almost 2-3 years. Just focused on building out our next tech stack. We had identified a bunch of places to make a bunch of optimizations. And that took us, you know, almost 2-3 years to get through R&D and building and finally deploying. And then we finally launched Sonic, you know, and I think it is a testament to the work that has been put in. I think it is by far the most responsive chain out there. Yeah.
Let's rewind and just what were the problems that you were trying to solve? Like when you set out to build a tech stack, you obviously set out with some kind of like saying, look, I don't like what's out there. I need to build something that's different from what's out there. What was the main pain points that you were trying to solve?
Well, so even when we started with Phantom, right, back in, what was that, 2018, I have to admit, we were fumbling through the dark a little bit. So like a pretty obvious bottleneck at the time was proof of work. So we hyper-focused on what's the fastest consensus we can build. And we built the Phantom's ABFT consensus, which is still being used in Sonic today. And I still think it's the gold standard of consensus. I don't really think you can get faster than it, because its only bottleneck is the speed at which you can transmit data. And that's, you know, that's a physics limit. So we're kind of capped there. But as the years progress and our treasury grew, you know, it stopped being kind of like a hobby project with a few guys. And we started getting some real expertise on board. And I'm talking about some of the best VM guys, the best compiler guys. So we kind of didn't go the, hey, blockchain people are out. We dissected the chain into its very specific niche components, you know, a compiler, a VM, a processor, et cetera, et cetera. And we got the experts in their representative fields. Primary example being Professor Bernard Schultz from Sydney, who is, I mean, he's probably the forefather of VMs. And we approached it from a performance engineering perspective. So when we got those guys on board, the first thing they said is, look, you guys have all of these theories about how you can make it faster, but let's measure and validate. So they spent about a year building a tool called Tosca that basically allows us to do down to like IO level measuring of where the stack is busy spending time when you send a transaction or when you're doing a block or stuff like that. And then, you know, they identified. So for example, when we started this exercise, you know, we had thought, let's do parallel execution, because yes, that seems like an obvious low-hanging fruit, right?
Yes.
I mean, currently everything's going synchronous. If we do it parallel, it's going to be faster. And then after we did that performance engineering exercise and we actually measured, turns out the parallel isn't that much. Like the complexity of how the stuff is in the block, you're not getting that kind of throughput. That, when implemented, would give us like a 30% lift on transactions. And now you have to remember, our consensus at that point could already do upwards of 50,000 to 60,000 transactions. But our limiting factor was the EVM. Our absolute max cap was 200, no matter how fast our consensus got. So the EVM was the part that we needed to focus. So parallel transactions seemed to make sense. Parallel transactions on standard EVM is going to give you about a 30% throughput lift. So, you know, we would have gone from 200 to 260, not significant in any kind of real terms. So the bigger bottleneck turns out was the database. And kind of in hindsight, it's obvious, but at the time, we didn't even think about it, because the database is spending a lot of, all of the databases currently used on blockchains are really generalized databases. You know, if it's PebbleDB, LevelDB, doesn't matter. It's a generalized database that's designed for anyone to be able to store arbitrary data in it. Now, with that comes a bunch of compromises. So when you store data there at the back end, you know, it's generating indexes and stuff to help you lookups and stuff that help you with your structured query language and all of these extra things that aren't necessarily beneficial or even used in blockchain databases. So we threw all of those away. We did a bunch of tests with a bunch of different ones, and all of them showed that, hey, if we do something very, very bespoke for blockchain data, for the specific like Merkle Patricia tree, we're going to get a lot more throughput. So we spent, and think about another almost year and a bit, developing Karman, the database, Karman DB, which is now sort of our flagship database. And that alone, aside from the benefits to nodes and validators, because right off the bat, that's a just above a 98% storage reduction. So that means, you know, normally you'd need a validator that has 10 terabytes of data capacity to be able to store all of the transactions on chain. Now that's down to like 10 gigabytes. It's a huge difference. So all of a sudden our hardware requirements are significantly less, to the point where we can run on like cell phones and Raspberry Pis and stuff. And then the other thing, read writes in terms of transaction execution and lookup, increased by 8.1x, about 810%. So that over the 200 is already a much bigger leap in performance than anything else. And then on the specific VM, you know, we started looking at things like, for example, using supersets instead of default opcodes. So what that means, if you look at something like an ERC20 transfer, it is a sequence of steps that is almost always exactly the same. There's a where you read your balance, you read the counterparty's balance, you then subtract the amount you want to transfer from your balance, you add it to the counterparty's balance, you store yours, you store theirs. So that always happens in the same sequence. And that's six opcodes that always have to run through. So each one, you know, has a start, an execution, an end, then the next, the next, the next. A superset goes, okay, but how about we bundle all of that into a single, you know, execution opcode? So now already you're saving that entire extra memory space because you're using just the single execution. You gain all of that throughput. Now, the supersets are a little bit more sensitive to the actual transactions happening. For example, if people now completely stop doing ERC20 transfers, you're not going to get that speed because it's specifically designed to optimize ERC20 transfers. So that's a little bit of an iterative process we have to constantly do. And just let me know if I'm getting too technical.
No, it's all good.
But you know, there's a ton of like each time. So now we would add Karman and we run it through Tosca again Ada. That's the testing tool. Tosca is our new VM. So we run it for Ada, and that now tells us where's the next big bottleneck. And now, okay, cool. That's opcode execution. So let's do supersets. Now we run it for Ada again, and then we see, okay, cool. The next one is, you know, the compiler. So we start working on that. So progressively, we're just kind of knocking out the next one until we get to that absolute max theoretical throughput of what a blockchain can do. We're not there yet. I think we can still at about probably get 3 to 4 times more out of the chain when we're done with everything.
So, but you know, where are you? Let's talk about like where are you? So you say you're not there yet. Where are you guys now? What are the what have you seen? What have you achieved? And then I want to talk about what you think you can achieve. You're saying you're not there yet, so you haven't hit the destination. So what do you think you can achieve?
Well, okay, starting at where we're at, you know, there's a bunch of sort of technical metrics, which I don't necessarily like to use because they're highly manipulatable, but I will mention them nonetheless, and I'll add the caveat every single time. So transactions per second has obviously been a big metric for a very long time. Not necessarily a bad metric. Now, if you look at transactions per second, a transaction can be very different. So if I'm just transferring money to you, that's the most base transaction you can get in a blockchain. It's super cheap. It's super fast. It doesn't need to touch the EVM. It costs about 20,000 gas, 21,000 gas to use. If you're just spamming those, we reach currently somewhere between 500,000 to 600,000 transactions per second. So,
wow, okay.
But that's if you're a payment network. You know, if we were MasterCard or Visa or something, that's fantastic because that's all we need to do. But that's not what blockchains today really are. You know, they're execution virtual machines. So now as an example, right, that raw transfer costs 21,000. Something like a swap in an AMM is going to cost you probably 400,000. So, I mean, you can already see the massive jump in gas required from the 21,000 transactions to 400,000 transactions.
20X, but those,
we call them both transactions, right?
Yeah.
So if you start talking about like super, super complex transactions, like a flash loan here and then a trade and a collateral block there and a borrow, then we've benchmarked around 16,000 to 20,000 concurrent transactions per second. Which is a more accurate metric. And then if you look at like just standard sort of throughput data, so you're not pushing the upper bound, our sort of comfortable number is somewhere between 8,000 to 10,000. So it can go higher, but you're going to start hitting the limits of what the machines can do.
And how much more do you think you can achieve? Like how much more do you think you can, and how much more do you think you need to achieve? Because that sounds like a big number of transactions. Like,
Yeah. Look, but now to qualify, right? Like I can get Bitcoin to do that number. If you just make the block sizes big enough, you're going to hit that number eventually as well. Like if you make now a petabyte block size, you're going to hit 1 million transactions per second on Bitcoin. So that's why that's one metric. A more important metric to me that I sort of loosely refer to as responsiveness is from when I, you know, click that submit button to when it tells me it's done. Some blockchains refer to that as block time.
Yeah.
Now, if you measure block time, and I'll explain why I disagree with that metric, but if you measure block time, then our blocks are generated about every 300 to 400 milliseconds.
Okay.
Now, for us, that's about as theoretically fast as we can get because it is a distributed network and part of that latency is just communication between the validators. I mean, if you've got two validators sitting in the same data center, you can hit 10 milliseconds easily. If they're in two different data centers, but on the same continent, you can hit somewhere between 40 to 80 milliseconds.
So there you're constrained by physics. Constrained by physics. That's not a blockchain problem. That's a physics problem. And I think when you're talking about 0.35 milliseconds, that's it. I mean, that's as fast as you're going to get it.
Yeah, ultimately. So, but and that's all right because, you know, from a user experience, you don't really notice. I mean, you click submit, it's done. The time you release your finger off of the button, it's confirmed. Now, the reason why I disagree with block times necessarily is, you know, if you look now again, using something like Bitcoin as the example, the block time there is 30 minutes. So you can wait, well, depends on the configuration and the solving. It can go be as low as 10, but still, let's for argument's sake, let's go with 30 minutes, right? So, but you can't just wait for one block. Because that could be overwritten by a different block. So one isn't enough for you to know that your transaction is what they call final.
Finalized.
So finality starts coming into the play, finalized, right? Now, something like a lot of networks have probabilistic finality. In other words, it is that point where so many blocks have been written on top of the one in which your transaction was that the chances of it being reorganized is incredibly low.
Yes.
Now, Sonic and our consensus, we don't actually generate blocks. So our consensus is actually purely happening on the peer-to-peer network. So when the transactions are distributed across the network, and then the network feeds back to say they are aware of this transaction, at that point, it's finalized. You have finality. There is no way to spin that transaction around. So our actual finality, yeah.
Just go back to when you say there's no blocks, just explain the concept to me of not having blocks. Are you saying that the transactions are cleared as they happen and they're not cleared in batches in different blocks?
Well, so proof of work, right? If we look at that, someone's trying to solve a cryptographic puzzle. Once they solve it, then they're allowed to propose the block. So at that point in time, that validator, that proposer, takes a bunch of transactions because it wants those fees and it puts them in the block and then it sends the block out. So everything is about that block. If you look at something like, you know, standard POS or Ethereum or most voting based system, again, the proposer will build the block. It'll send them out to everyone. It'll ask them, hey, please vote on this block if you agree. Once, you know, 66% of the network stake has agreed, then that block is considered completed. Fine. And then they move on to the next block. Because our consensus is entirely transaction based, so we don't send out the blocks to them. So if you consider that previous example with the proof of stake, right? the validators are still communicating all of the transactions, all of the times to all validators, so that when they finally propose that block, everyone has awareness of those transactions. So the transactions is kind of being, in any case, propagated as a secondary process. So all we do really in our consensus is we acknowledge we're going to be sending out those transactions in any case. So instead of just sending out the transaction, we send out a little bit of extra information, which is also, who am I aware of that also are aware of this transaction? And that little bit of extra metadata means that at some point, you as validator are aware that at least 66% of the network are aware of this transaction. And if 66% of the network are aware of the transaction, then it's finalized. There's nothing you can do anymore. So now if you go onto, like, you know, ChainSpec, the website you had opened earlier, and you see there's a thing called block times. So what we actually do is, after the fact, we output a block. And the reason we do that is so that we have compatibility with wallets and RPCs and all of the standard infrastructure. Because none of them have awareness of, like, our consensus. So so those blocks that we send out are actually a little bit slower than the actual transactions get finalized. Because that's an after-the-fact process that happens.
So you're doing the block. You're doing the block more to follow a protocol.
Compatibility.
That's why you're doing blocks. You don't really need to do the blocks because you've got a different consensus, so to speak. Your consensus is, what do you call the consensus? What is that? Like, is there a name for it?
Well, it's just asynchronous BFT, really. The original work it's based off is called CCK, Reasoning About Concurrent Knowledge. It's old, hey? Like, this is distributed computing back from, like, the 1980s.
If this is like so old and so obvious, because the way you make it sound is like, this is so obvious, like you should have just done this and this and this. Why didn't anybody else do it? Like,
yeah, why didn't anyone invent the iPhone? Why didn't anyone invent the PC? The first person to do it is the first person to do it. It's ultimately what it comes down to. All great inventions that have changed our lives are always so obvious in hindsight.
So are you now claiming the fastest and cheapest blockchain around? Like, is that what
we've built? I'm not claiming. We've proven that on the numbers. So, like, you can go. Other people are claiming that. Third parties who are not, you know, our team are claiming that. Because it doesn't help we claim it. Because every week there's another new blockchain supposedly launching that, you know, has magically solved all of the problems of the world. They're even faster than physics. You know, so it doesn't help for us to claim. Third parties need to claim it. And by third-party metrics, yes, we're the fastest.
What about decentralization? Because that would be the other part of the trilemma, is saying, okay, you built a very fast blockchain and it really works, but are you decentralized? Like that's what the naysayers are going to come back and challenge with, right?
I mean, look, the easiest argument there is attack the system, and we haven't had any successful attacks since inception with this consensus. No one has been able to override. And I mean, that's right. Your decentralization test is, can someone attack this? It is reliant on proof of stake. So you always have that sort of stake. What's the word? Consolidation, you know, like, people like to delegate to the biggest validators. So we've tried to add stuff like, you know, there's limits to how much you can delegate. There's limits to how much you can self-stake, to kind of push more validator decentralization instead of kind of everything naturally gravitating towards one, because it's Pareto principle, right? Eventually 80% would be consolidated to one and everyone would prefer that. So we've had to implement hard caps to prevent that, which does mean there's more validators. But again, so as I said, our max throughput is entirely dependent on our network topography. So on the one hand, if it's super centralized to one server, that's actually fantastic, because then all of a sudden our block times are going to go down to 1 millisecond, which I would prefer. But logically, the block times are as slow as the network is decentralized. So right now you have multiple validators across multiple data centers across multiple continents. And that's why our max is about 400, because that's just the time to communicate from, like, America to Asia and Asia to America. It just takes that long.
Okay, so it's fast, it's cheap, it's decentralized. So you've now got the fastest, cheapest decentralized blockchain. But there's also economic innovation. let's call it economic innovation. I think one of the biggest economic innovations, I say it's an economic innovation, even though a lot of people have spoken about it before and some have tried to implement it. I think the fee monetization is probably, for me, that's the biggest economic innovation on the chain, right?
I agree. So we spent, I mean, it's important to note that sort of when we originally launched the first Phantom Network, at that point in time, we also were able to, by independent third parties, claim that we were the fastest, cheapest, most decentralized. At that time, you know, there wasn't really VM, there wasn't really smart contract, there wasn't really apps. So there wasn't actually much happening on the chain. So I spent a lot of time then building apps because I wanted to understand that journey. You know, just providing the blockchain doesn't mean much if you're only using it for transfers. So I spent the better half of, you know, 4 or 5 years building smart contract apps, some of which successful, some of which less successful. But that let me understood the pain points that app developers face. And in today's day and age, you know, blockchains are more like virtual network states. And you're just a piece of land. You need to provide the infra, you know, the electricity, the piping, the sewage, whatever, but you're not the thing that's attracting people to come to you. It's the stores and the merchants that set up on top of you that attract the people. So our focus then shifted to, okay, what are these pain points and how do we solve them for our app developers? And having been an app developer, you know, uniquely positioned for that, which I think most other blockchains don't have. And the main point pain points are these sort of incentive alignment things. So the first one, and this is the easiest one, is the fee monetization, which we already tested on Phantom to great success. And now we're just scaling it up. So on Phantom, we did 15%. Our dApp devs loved it. A few of them actually survived because of it, which is awesome. Now we just ranked it up to 90%. So basically how it works is every time you submit a transaction on chain, there's a fee you pay. And normally 100% of that fee goes to your validators, your miners, whatever it is. We did the economic test to see, okay, does it break economics if instead of the validators, we give it to someone else? Because validators still need a little bit of a fee because they're providing the security of the network. So it's still important. So the validators get 10%. The other 90% of that fee goes to the dApp developer that is the reason for that transaction. So comparatively, as an example, and I think Uniswap is a great example of this because Uniswap recently launched Unichain. And why did they launch Unichain? Because they're an AMM. Why would they need to launch a chain?
Because this was the only way they could capture value. That was the only reason they did it is because they couldn't capture the value being a dApp. And therefore, the only way they could capture value was creating another chain.
Correct. Because if you look at Uniswap, they have for the apps that the blockchain that they deployed on, since inception, they have generated $2.8 billion dollars of fees.
Yeah, I see that.
Of which they did not see a cent. 2.8 billion. That's a ridiculous number.
And that went so, that went 100% to the ETH validators. 100%.
Correct. 100%. Okay. They didn't see a cent of it.
So
naturally they would launch their L2 then, right? Because if you launch an L2, that's how you capture the 90%. So we're already saying, hey, you don't need to launch an L2. You don't need to be an app gen. We're going to give you that 90%. And now the other, and I'll do a little bit of a pitch here about why the 90% fee monetization that we're doing is better than launching your own L2. Because I think what a lot of these L2s don't realize is the sort of behind the scenes hidden costs to running
an L2
layer. Whether it's you know, integrating into exchanges, whether it's wallets, infra, oracles, third party incentives, there's $10 to $20 million you need to pay out of your pocket just to get the basic tooling on your chain so that other people can come to start building. You know, if you don't have the right RPCs, you don't have the graph, you don't have the right wallet infra, you don't have Safe, whatever else it is, then these teams can't come and deploy on you because this is infra they require to deploy their apps. So with Sonic, you deploy there, you get the 90% in any case that you would have captured when you have an L2, and you're only going to get 90% because 10% needs to be written back to Ethereum to leverage their security. But now you get the benefit of all of the exchange integrations, all of the RPCs, all of the tooling, everything we've already paid out of pocket for that. Okay, but now the next argument, right? You get 90% of the fees. We have some of the cheapest fees in the world. So that doesn't, Ethereum, they made $2.8 billion, but that's because you're paying, you know, $60 per transaction.
Per swap, yeah, per swap.
You do it on Sonic, you're going to pay 0.0001 cent. So, I mean, it's not going to be that big numbers. So you can't just do fee monetization in isolation. So the next thing we realized is we need to provide our developers a way that they can charge the fees they would like to earn. So the next thing we're releasing is dynamic fees that allows the contract owners to be able to set how much do they think their users are going to be willing to pay. And that's something they need to figure out based on their app, you know, because some, like a financial app, can probably get away with charging $1, $2 for a transaction. You know, a gaming app, they want to keep it as cheap as humanly possible so that people can do as many transactions. So some of them are going to be volume-based and others are going to be, you know, high fee value-based.
So what you're saying is
that each app figures out with its own users.
What you're saying is that as an app itself achieves network effects, they could increase the fees and therefore earn exponentially more because they've got the network effects and because now they've got dynamic fees and they're capturing 90. If they increase the fee, will they still capture 90% or will they capture
always 90%?
So you want
whoever you are, whatever you deploy, you earn 90%. That's full stop.
So if they raise the fees to $40, $4 is going to Sonic and $36 is going to them. If it's $4, if the fee's $4, they're going to keep $360 and they're going to give $40 to
look, that's a game they need to play with their users, right? It's like any standard subscription model. Some stuff you're willing to pay $9 a month for, but you're not willing to pay $900 a month for, right? And so it might happen that fine, they have millions of users, they raise it from 4 to 40, but all of a sudden their user base drops by 90%. You know, then the net result ends up being about the same, and then there's more value in them charging less than more. But that's the standard economic game that any company in the world plays, right? So they need to figure out what their pricing point is for what their users are willing to pay for the service that they're providing.
So now there's more incentive. Now there's more incentive for more apps to build because they know that if they are successful, they can increase the cost of subscription without increasing the cost of subscription. That's effectively. Exactly. Effectively, what they can do. Okay, so then the next thing is,
not done yet. So now the next thing, as an app developer, the biggest pain point I found with trying to onboard users is as soon as they open my website, the first thing I need to tell them is go and install this wallet. And then the next thing I need to tell them is go and buy this random token you've never heard of this random exchange you've never used, and then deposit that stuff into that wallet, and then you can use my app. Now, you can imagine, right, if you subscribe to Netflix and the first thing they do is they tell you, hey, quickly go register with Chase Bank or F&B or whatever. I mean, can you imagine how many users are actually going to go through that journey? Zero. So the next thing, so we're kind of working back from there. So the next thing that we're releasing is fee subsidies. Now, fee subsidies allow you natively to be able to subsidize any transaction. So you can say, hey, for all of my users, for up to the first, let's say 100S, I'm going to subsidize all of that. So now they can do free transactions up until the limit that you set. And that has a nice flywheel effect with the fee monetization, because I can take the fees I generate from the paying guys, use that to subsidize for my new guys, and then increase my onboarding ratio with that. So fee subsidies is the next big one we're releasing. And then it's the like last the one days, is native abstraction.
It's like in the old days when you used to have a reverse charges phone call where you used to phone and say, do you accept the charges? And it's exactly the same mechanism.
Correct. It removes that barrier. And then the last one, we're completely getting rid of wallets. So everything's just going to be smart accounts and you're going to use passkey, OAuth, Google login, whatever the hell. Like, it doesn't prohibit people that want to get wallets and that want to get gas. They can still do that. But, you know, we want to get to a point where if you're using a dApp on Sonic, you don't know it's a Sonic dApp and you don't even know it's blockchain, right? I mean, so as an example, another difference with us, a big thing for us right now is actually sitting with all of the apps that have deployed on us and getting them to rework their UIs. So what's pretty standard in blockchain is you submit the transaction via the RPC. And then in the back end, you start a little timer that like waits a second and then asks, is the transaction done? Waits another second. Is it done? Waits another second. Oh, cool, it's done. And then you inform the user it's done. The thing about Sonic and ignoring the block, just when you submit it via the RPC, it waits until the 2/3 of the network know. So by the time that RPC comes back to you and says 200 okay, your transaction's finalized. So for a lot of these guys, they submit the transaction and they start a thread, you're waiting, but it's already done. So like we're actually getting them to rewrite their UIs to completely ignore that asynchronous logic and just make it pure synchronous. Because when you submit and you get the response, your transaction's final. And like that's our biggest like sort of slow down. Like if you look at any of these videos of people using Sonic, you'll see they like click the button and then they have to wait for the wallet to load. That's the slowest part. And by the time they click submit on the wallet, the UI has already told them it's done.
That's incredible. I mean,
super proud of it.
This is incredible. Okay, so next question is, how do you bring the apps, the users? And like, I mean, you said that you spent 5 years building apps or dApps in the last cycle. Is your work building the layer one now occupying a lot of your time, or is your work now, because I know you're the master dApp deployer, but you're also the master builder. So the question is, how much of your mind share now is around making the L1 more optimized, and how much of your mind share right now is, okay, what am I going to launch? Because you've teased a couple of launches. So,
Yeah. No, I've got a launch plan that's in the work. We're just waiting to connect with the right regulatory units in the US so that I can launch it in a compliant fashion. It's going positive, but it's as slow as you can imagine doing regulatory stuff. But it's why I'm in the US currently, you know, because at least now they're willing to have that conversation. A year ago, they wouldn't even respond to the bloody email. Now for you sure. Can actually sit in a call with them, and they're actually, I have to say, pretty open to trying to figure out how it's going to work forward. We're not there yet, but we'll get there. So I'll probably be able to launch within the next 3 to 6 months, maybe a little bit longer, depending on how long they. But now to sort of circle back to the original question about where my brain is at. So all of those experts and all of those relative fields, you know, VM compiler, execution, consensus, whatever, those guys, they're really the ones driving the performance, because that's what they think about, you know, day and night. When they wake up, it's the problem they think about. When they eat, it's the problem. When they sleep, it's the problem.
But who's orchestrating them? Who's the orchestra master who's saying, you do this, you do
that's
this?
That's Schultz. That's Professor Bernard Schultz. No. He's currently running, I think, 6 different teams across the world to kind of coordinate all of this. So their mandate is really make the fastest chain humanly possible. It's out of my field of expertise at this point. Like the level of detail and expertise these guys have, you know, these are people that have dedicated 40 years of their lives to a specific problem. Mm-hmm. They're all smarter than me, every single one of them. Where my mind is at, I'm always thinking about it from that app user journey, you know? So if I now want to deploy my app, what's my next pain point? And then that's my feed in to the Sonic organization, you know? So stuff like fee monetization, fee subsidies, all of those things make the network slower, not faster, because they add extra overhead on each and every single transaction. So if you know, Schultz and those guys were left to their devices, they would never allow these features. Every single time, it's a little bit of a sort of tussle with them to actually get them to kind of accept why these requests are important, because they don't want to add anything that makes it slower. But they also need to, it took about a year of actually fighting for everyone in the organization to buy into the fact that just being the fastest blockchain isn't going to save us. Like, that's not going to make us the most used. The thing that makes us the most used is if we have the most apps that the users enjoy using. That's all it comes down to. So all of my focus is really going into, how do I make the experience for the apps that I'm planning on launching better for my users? And that implicitly feeds into, you know, other developers as well, because then they're also getting the benefit of sort of that vision / wants and needs.
And what kind of apps do you think are going to be coming to Sonic? And the reason why I say that is we've just been through a meme coin super clusterfuck. So I think I'm in super cycle. And then we got AI agents, which is also AI agent super cycle. And I mean, it seems to me like, even though we're in very early days in Sonic, it seems to be DeFi centric. Now
it's DeFi for now, and it'll keep being DeFi until we can launch all 4 of the features that I mentioned: fee subsidies, fee monetization, etc. So for now, you know, people still need wallets. People still need gas. So the thing that makes the most sense now is decentralized finance with its composability and its benefits to those users. And I also think it's a certain comfort level. And we have, thanks to kind of the network we've built up and stuff, we've got a team of guys that know DeFi probably better than any other chain. So a lot of what they're constantly doing is figuring out ways how the teams work together, what's composable, how to build off on top of each other so that they create this massive ecosystem. But for now, yes, it's definitely raw core DeFi focused.
And how
there's an emergent market there, though, that you can already see what gaming is going to look like in 6 or so months from now. And that's Fate Adventure, Sacrify, and S4 Kingdom. Those three, you won't realize you're playing on blockchain if you're playing those games. They're fun. They're addictive. They're already the best iteration of, I don't even want to call it crypto gaming. It's just gaming that happens on the blockchain. But they have to do some centralized things like using relayers to pay for gas, you know, stuff that when we release fee subsidies happen on chain, they're now doing off chain. But they're already a good example of what it's going to look like. So within 6 to 12 months, you know, I think gaming will be another big cycle. And along with that, gaming is really a subset of, you know, social. So you're going to have a social layer emerging, social apps, social media, social messaging, streaming, all of those things will be sort of the next iteration. But you first have to remove those barriers of like wallet and gas. And once those are removed, we can start seeing those apps. And but fast forward 5 years, and you know, blockchains are just going to be the new internet. That's really all it is. So anything you see on the internet, you'll see on chain.
How long until you release like fee subsidization and dynamic fee markets? And
that's all within the next, I'd say the next big one is fee subsidies. That's probably the next 3 months. Then it is most likely dynamic fees, 6 months, and then native abstraction, probably 9 months. But it's all within this year.
Okay, and then so how do you incentivize app developers to build on the ecosystem? So the old model was you start a foundation. The foundation would hold, I don't know, a huge percentage of a token supply. They would run conferences. They deliver grants. They would find investors, and effectively they would spend the chain's tokens to subsidize the ecosystem. You are almost, your FTV is equal to your circulating supply, almost there or thereabout.
Yeah, other than block rewards, everything is circulating. It's just block rewards that are outstanding.
Yeah. So how do you incentivize the build? How do you incentivize?
Pretty much the same stuff. I mean, we have a ridiculous treasury. So, you know, we still do grants. We still do conferences. We still do those kinds of events. But I have to admit, those haven't been the biggest hooks. The biggest hooks for teams have been founder support. So, you know, like tweeting them out, me messaging about them, showing to people how they interact. That's been a big one. Fee monetization has been a big motivating factor with teams that actually now have a revenue stream that they can rely on. And like I say, a few of our teams like PaintSwap, S4 Kingdom, they made it through thanks to those fees. Also, fantastic NFT team. And then another big thing has just been us kind of interworking and networking our teams. Like that's been a very positive thing. And that by itself, a lot of these teams are interconnected or have, you know, employees that have been at a different one. So that network has helped a lot to convince other teams to come over as well. I think we stand out in terms of, you know, where people are still willing to try and innovate in terms of DeFi. We're seeing a lot of new stuff happening that haven't pre-been, and that also attracts a certain kind of developer that wants to experiment and play with that stuff. So it's a bit of the traditional sort of playbook, you know, in terms of conferences, grants, investments, these kinds of thing. But we're seeing a lot better ROI when it comes to supporting, you know, more the grassroots kind of stuff and like helping the teams interact. And I think a big thing for a lot of these teams is just we understand their product. So just by the nature of that, you know, we know where they fit into their ecosystem, who they should be talking to, how they should launch, what their strategy should be. And we're kind of uniquely positioned to advise on that stuff, you know, because we're not just focused on the layer one.
There's a massive airdrop that is about to happen. I mean, given that a lot of the features aren't launched yet, don't you think the airdrop is maybe a little bit premature? Like to airdrop such a big supply of the tokens before you've got before you've got like the main, not the main, but like a lot of the drivers to the chain built, do you not think maybe the airdrop is a little bit premature?
Well, so number one, I mean, the airdrop's only coming out June, right? Okay. That's when it actually releases. So by then you already have fee monetization and probably fee subsidies. And to me, those are the two big winners. Number two, numerically 200 million tokens sounds a lot, but our circulating is 3 billion. So all of a sudden, 200 million over 3 billion, a lot less than you'd actually think. It sounds a lot because people are comparing it to new chains launching and doing an airdrop. So, and they, when they do a number like that, it sounds big because, you know, they have like a float of their airdrop. So that's 100% of their supply going into circulation.
This
for
is
us,
6%.
It's 200 over 3,000. Like it's...
Yeah, 6%.
We're not that particularly worried about it. Then it's also designed to... It's not designed to attract liquidity, for example. It's designed specifically around interacting with specific protocols, doing certain things, trading perpetuals, options, playing with some of our games, doing a little bit of NFT stuff. It's designed as incentivized education. And we're specifically optimizing it so it doesn't favor the big fund that come deposits $1 billion and then they farm it for 6 months and then they sell and leave. Because that's not what we're interested in. We're interested in incentivizing people willing to experiment and come play. That's also part of it. Then the next part of it is of that 200 million, you know, that's dropped in different phases. The whole 200 isn't on June. There's three different phases to it. And even the tokens that we do drop in June, only 25% is liquid and the remaining is vested over time that, you know, if you just dump and leave, we can rug you on that stuff. So it's specifically designed to avoid these liquidity locusts, you know, these funds, these VCs, these big whales that come in, drop their stuff. Because what we took the conscientious decision right at the start is we don't want our TVL to look like most of these new launches. You know, they start with like 4 billion TVL. It looks great until it's unlocked. And then all of a sudden, pew, it's a straight way down.
You're doing the other thing.
Then for the rest of, we went the exact other way around. We decided we're not doing any of that. If you come to us, you're taking risk. We're not going to pre-lock your deposit. And that was a bit of a fight internally because a lot of the team wanted to do it. But I think it's a bad choice. I think it sets you up for failure going forward. So that's also part of it. And then the last part of it, it's designed to really make the guys who are really participating in our network right now rich. And that is so that they stick around, you know, because the one thing I learned with Yearn, if you make those early participants wealthy, they will carry your system for you. Like you, after that, you can actually retire and they will take care of it. And I mean, Yearn is an example of why that's been successful. So, you know, it has all of these bells and whistles of a normal airdrop campaign, but I think it's an unfair comparison because there's so many little micro tweaks we've done here to ensure that's not what we're optimizing for.
Amazing. So listen, you mentioned that one of the features here is that, you know, you talk about the apps and stuff like that, that's happening on the chain. So I know it's early days on the chain, but I know you've got an eye as to what's out there and what's happening. Anything that you think that the viewers here should go and look at, and maybe just give us like a little synopsis as to why they should go and look at them.
Yeah, gladly. So I like breaking it up into risk profiles, right? So I mean, every person has a different kind of risk appetite, and I think that's the way to kind of approach it. So if you're lowest risk, then, you know, you want to go check out the single-sided money markets. That's stuff like Euler or Euler. Every time I interact with them, they change how I'm supposed to pronounce their name. But anyway, either Euler or Euler or Euler, you choose.
Yes.
Silo has been absolutely phenomenal. That team has really been driving so much of our stuff. They're willing to engage. They help other teams. They play with stuff.
What does Silo do?
They've got
Silo. Silo
is also a money market, but as per the... As per their name says, you know, they're siloed markets. So where something like Aave or Compound, you'll have cross collateral. So anything you deposit, you can borrow anything and vice versa. This is one-to-one market. So for example, there's a S Sonic token to STS, which is Beats' liquid stake and token. And that's one-to-one. So you can provide S as collateral and borrow STS and then loop that to kind of optimize your yield and points and stuff. So it's isolated markets to kind of limit your risk exposure so that you don't have the full cross-collateral risk. They've got a point system as well on top of our point system. They've got great LTV rates. It's a great UI to work with and a very engaging team, which, you know, helps. Another good lending market that's currently launching is Vicuna. They're trying a whole new thing with Merkles and how the lending works. Also isolated markets, no cross collateral, but it's all about looping individual positions. But those are your safest ones, you know, because you've got single-sided risk against a single asset, with the only risk you really take is the counterparty of the thing that's being borrowed against it. But that's normally either a staking derivative. It's almost always some kind of staking derivative. So for USDC, for example, it's very often SCUSDC, which is Rings USDC, and that just earns you extra yield. It's one-to-one. It's one-to-one deposit and withdrawal. So there's no real risk other than if they were to get exploited or something, with which is unlikely because they're using VEDA underneath it.
With very crazy
with very good yield. And then, so that's sort of on the lowest risk. If you're willing to do medium risk, which means you're willing to take two token risk, that's when you start playing in the AMM world. Shadow, which is, I'd say, our biggest sort of VE33 decks now, they've done just a bunch of great stuff. They've integrated, obviously, concentrated liquidity, which is pretty standard on this. They've done quite a few iterations on my original VE33 model, but their big thing that fascinates me is X33. So the standard thing with VE33 is if you have that locked position, well, this is already one thing they do. So with my original design, there was no way to exit other than maturity of the position. So the first thing they did is they dropped that maturity from 4 years to 180 days. And then they allow you to exit at any time, but you forfeit 50% of your position. So that's going to be redistributed to the other guys.
Of but your now, position or of your of, or of the yield?
No, of your rewards. Of your rewards,
yeah.
So you still have your normal yield based on trading and stuff. This is additional incentives that they put on top of that because it's the whole VE33 flywheel. So you'll just take a 50% haircut on your rewards. But now those are NFT positions, so they're not fungible. So on top of that, they did like this Omega NFT X33 that's fungible. So it behaves like an ERC20 token. So you can trade the X33 normally and stuff. So now the mental model there would be that X33 would always trade at a 50% discount of the X Shadow, which is, you know, the main VE NFT thing. It doesn't. It trades at something like 90% equivalency. So for every, you know, $1, you can get 90 cents out. It's supposed to be at 50% because if you just vest your VE NFT the 180 days, if you don't want to wait the 180 days, you're going to take a 50% haircut. So this thing should realistically trade there, but for some reason, it's right up there at the edge. Now that's fascinating to me, right? Because that kind of doesn't make sense in the economics, but it's obviously kind of one, it's sort of future projected on what people expect the price to be over 180 days in one. And then the other thing that I didn't take into consideration is all of the fees that they accumulate with their X-Shadow NFT position. They bid every week on this X33. So, you know, they're earning like $5 million per week in fees that they now buy this X33 with. So you also see that every week before the buy, you know, there's a little up and then a little bit down over the week and then up again as they're constantly. It's so smart.
Very clever flywheel. It's a very clever flywheel.
Annoyed I never thought of it. But anyway, so kudos to them. Metropolis Dex, another great one. They're a DLMM, so, you know, not standard ALM. You can set your ranges and things. They've got a bunch of cool strategies and single-sided deposits and stuff that's a little bit more complex. You'll have to do a little bit of research, but there's a lot of fun playing around there. They also pay out in USDC. So if you have a position there, it's no weird token. It's clean dividend payout on the position you hold. And again, pretty good rates. SwapX is another good one. They're partnering with a bunch of teams to create really smart management strategies. So stuff like single-sided deposit on the one side with Ichi, also a bunch. So what I like is each one of these guys, you know, is trying to experiment something new. It's not just, hey, we copied Uniswap and we're doing this stuff. So those, I'm sure I'm missing some, but those are already great. Mm-hmm. Then if you want to start getting a little bit more exotic on the derivative side, BoomX is a perpetual exchange. Even if you just go open a tiny position, like a dollar's worth, like I recommend someone to go play with it because just so you can feel the speed, it feels faster than most centralized exchanges and it'll show people that interaction. Vertex also released another good one. On the option side, there's Margin Zero, there's Strike. Again, this is more exotic stuff, but they all have yield opportunities. They all have strategies. I know Margin Zero, for example, they're busy tokenizing their vaults that underwrite those options so that it's just something you deposit USDC in and you get the yield of those premiums of those options being written, which I also think is, you know, a really cool thing. Vertex is busy doing staking derivative collateral so that you can create, you know, USD Athena style tokenized per positions. Also really cool. I feel like I'm definitely forgetting something. That there's Stable, there's Jack, who are, you know, they're all about leverage position. Pendle just launched.
Pendle just launched.
Yield opportunities there.
I saw the yield opportunities. It seemed a bit absurd, actually.
It's everything is, you know, all it really is, it's the expectation of future yield. And like our future yield is kind of insane currently. So look, these numbers die down, right?
They're not going to be four digit APY forever.
As TVL grows, as participation grows, it's going to come down. But I do consider, you know, I consider any of these opportunities, even with complexity, significantly lower risk than, you know, trying to gamble on meme coins, just to be blunt.
If you want to go max risk. Yeah.
No, well, we can. I'll get to me. I just want to do this last one. So max risk. This is mostly stuff that's all going to zero. Pay attention. This is not you deposit and forget about it. You need to be actively watching and you need to be monitoring everything. But we have a lot of teams trying to, again, innovate sort of on algorithmic stablecoins, on rebalance, on rebasing. There's Hand of God. There's Hubble. There's Snake. There's a long list of these guys. They're not just forks of the original stuff. Oh, there's Eggs, which is surprisingly working well.
Yes, Eggs is actually, But wait.
Shocking how well it's actually going.
I think you can't get an egg now, can you?
I think they still have... No, well, but you can't mint them anymore. Yeah. You can still technically buy them. But yeah. I mean, those the burns... Pretty soon you won't be able to get them, I think, is what it comes down to. And then I'm curious to see what happens, because then it's a little bit of a stalemate between people willing to redeem versus who are willing to actually, you know, buy or sell it. Anyway, a lot of new innovation happening there of people trying, but these are things that have historically all gone to zero, which is why be careful, pay attention. But what I also like and respect about these teams is they're very transparent about that. You know, they're not trying to convince you that this is safe, 20 billion APY yield. They very much tell you, look, these are the risks. This is what can go wrong. This is how it can fail. Pay attention. Be sensitive to time. But again, max risk. And then if you just want to have fun, the gaming stuff that I really recommend, I play it almost every day. It's Fate Adventure, which is like Pokemon-style game. Really good. There's Sacrify, S-A-C-R-A-F-I. Really hard, like Dark Skull / old school, you know, mud games. And then there's Est4 Kingdom, which is done by the PaintSwap team. It's also our main NFT exchange, which that's just like Stardew Valley level, you know, comfort food in terms of gaming. And every day there's new stuff, right? Like, I mean, it's constantly evolving, which is what I'm loving. But there's so much experimentation happening, which is making me really excited.
You sound disinterested in meme coins, and I'm interested to know your view. Like, is it...
So my stance on it, right, is I like to actually split it up into two things. There's what I call community coins, and then there's meme coins. Like, if you look at all of the big meme coins, whether it's Bonk, Doge, doesn't matter what it is, you know, these are coins that have existed for years before they got any kind of attention. So to me, those coins are, I think of the meme as sort of the war banner that these guys, you know, fought and died together for years before they finally got some recognition or won the war. So you'll see we have a meme mania competition, right? But that meme mania, that's rewarding memes that have been with us since Phantom days. Like, these are guys that have existed for years, and we want to reward them. We want to reward those communities. When on the other side, you know, this, you have this new sort of genre of very low attention. You have 5 minutes to get in or you won't make it, you know, time sensitive meme scams. I don't think you can call it anything else.
Extractive memes.
They are worthless. Like I don't want to see them. If you're planning on launching them, you won't get support from us. In fact, a few of some of the other blockchains, people who are used to these strategies, tried coming over. Our community has been hardened over years. They very quickly call out that stuff and attack those people. It's like a white blood cell response in our system where you're just going to get attacked and driven out. And we as founders and, you know, team leads will amplify that. We're not going to hide because of the volume. We're not interested in that volume. So that, I think, is pointless. That I don't want to cultivate. But rewarding those, you know, age-old communities where those guys really fought through hardships, they deserve it. That's something different. Those are community coins. To me, that's beautiful. But this overnight meme coin stuff, no. No, that needs to just die out.
Andrew, before I let you go, like, how are you feeling now on a satisfaction point of view? Like, this has been a long time in the making. You've launched it. It's working. It works. It looks cool. There has been a lot of hype about it. I mean, the markets haven't been kind to any token. I think Sonic has been done very well given what the market's doing to the rest of the altcoin market. Like, how are you feeling as a human? And the reason why I say that is because you've done a lot. You've achieved a lot. You've been knocked down a few times. Some have been amazing. Some have taken a toll on you personally. We met a while ago, and I think we had a good conversation about how ruthless this blockchain space is on people. You've risen from the ashes again. Let's say that. And I think you've done an incredible, incredible launch. How are you feeling personally? Satisfied, proud?
Unsatisfied and hungry, but very proud. Like, I'm proud of the team. The technical team, like I said, I do think they're the best in the industry currently, and that's because they're not a blockchain team. You know, they're hyper-focused teams of like 5 to 6 people that are the experts in their respective fields. Like, if you go talk to them, they wouldn't even tell you they're working on blockchain, because, you know, they're working on database, VM, disk, throughput. It's such niche. So they're phenomenal. Then the internal BD and marketing team, Sam, Matt, Johan, Seg, I mean, those guys know Wizards. DeFi and dApps Wizards. And app complexity better than even myself. So, you know, what they've done is really cultivated that environment. So proud. I'm incredibly, incredibly proud of all of these people and all of these teams and everything they've launched. At the same time, I am completely unsatisfied because we are 10% of where we need to be. Wow. This is the next big unlock, and this allows me, for example, to do my next apps. But there's still such a big roadmap in front of us that we're not taking a pause to do a victory celebration here, because I don't think it's time for a victory celebration. You know, I'm excited that the market is responding positively. It makes me super happy every time I read about someone coming over from a different blockchain and then like experiencing our speed and then just being blown away by it. But, you know, eventually our apps get saturated with TVL and those numbers go down. The excitement goes down. We're just another blockchain in this space. And it's that what I want to keep driving and pushing, right? Because the stuff that's happening now isn't the work we put in now. That's the work we've put in the previous 4 years. And now we have to continue putting in that work for the next. So, yeah, unsatisfied and hungry, I'd say. But ultimately, very, very proud of the team.
Yeah, listen, I just say to anyone who's watching this, just do yourself a favor. Just go and test any app. Go and do a transaction on Sonic.
It is 2 seconds. Click on something.
It's the craziest thing. By the time, I think you said it in the beginning, but by the time your finger's off the button, the transaction is done. It's finalized. It's done. It's in your wallet. It's finished. Andre, my friend, so good to see you. Thank you so much for the time. I know you're pretty busy heads down, and I know I've been trying to schedule this, but much love, bro. This is, I've been following the journey for years. I mean, we started together on the original Phantom.
Yeah, you've been there since 2017, I think, man.
Yeah.
So it's been a long ride.
I think the first time we met was actually in Korea when you were working on, I was at CNBC and you were working on Phantom. Anyway, thank you, my friend. Sending so much love from the community, and we'll obviously keep touching base as the journey progresses. Thank you, sir. And to you guys, thank you. To you guys, the Banter fam. Wow. I mean, just do yourself a favor. Go and do one transaction on Sonic. Just go and do it. It's a step change from what you're currently used to. Anyway, I'll see you guys again either on the weekend or on Monday. Until then, trade well, my friends.